Welcome to the UK Investor Magazine podcast, the latest on shares, markets and investments, now available on your Amazon Alexa.
NBE Private Equity Partners, NBPE, is a London-listed investment trust that invests directly in private companies alongside leading private equity managers rather than through funds, a rare approach amongst investment trusts. It's managed by Neuberger Berman, a private, independent, employee-owned investment manager rather than being publicly listed or owned by other financial institutions. Its private markets division manages over $155 billion in active capital and uses its global network to access investment opportunities. Welcome to this podcast. I'm Jeremy Naylor. I'm talking today to Luke Mason, principal in the NB private equity team. Luke, good to talk to you.
Thanks, Jeremy. Lovely to be here. Thank you for allowing me on.
Let's begin with this investment approach and ask what you perceive to be the advantages of this type of investment strategy.
Of course. As you mentioned, you know, NBPE, London-listed investment trust, which invests in private companies to generate long-term growth. And we, rather than investing through funds, we invest alongside private equity managers in what we call co-investment. And as many people know, private equity comes in many forms, but at its core is making investments into private companies for the long term, with private equity managers creating value through active ownership. In NBPE's case, we are primarily focused on mid-market buyout transactions. What I mean by that is we back established, profitable and growing businesses with proven business models and cash flows rather than early stage or venture companies where maybe the path to profitability and scale is more uncertain. The trust launched in 2007, and today the portfolio is about $1.2 billion in size across about 68 investments, predominantly in the mid-market, as I mentioned, and we invest alongside about 45 different private equity managers, or as we sometimes call them, sponsors. About 70% in the US, with about 23% in European companies, and we're broadly diversified across sectors, with the largest being industrials and industrial technology, tech, media and telecoms, and financial services. Maybe the last thing to say, within the portfolio, we actually focus on two core themes, looking at businesses with low expected cyclicality and those with strong long-term secular growth. We've deliberately tilted the portfolio to focus on these areas, you know, looking for companies whose sales and profits don't swing wildly with kind of macroeconomic headlines, and which operate in markets that are steadily getting bigger over time and driven by technology and adoption and demographic or regulatory change. Maybe to your point on what differentiates us from others, or the focus on direct investment, I think is really important. As you mentioned, we're relatively unique in the London market as being the only investment trust that's solely focused on co-investment. And in our mind, the co-investment approach combines especially the best of both worlds. You get the benefit of direct investment into companies where we control the investment decision. As you mentioned, we don't go through funds, but also you get the diversification across different private equity managers and also sectors and companies. Maybe a couple of points I just want to highlight is it's very fee efficient. So as a co-investor, we typically don't pay underlying fees on any of the deals we do. And this is different from if you invest in a primary or secondary fund, where you're typically paying fees and performance fees on the underlying investments. And the last point, it's very capital efficient. So we control the investment decision. We can, you know, build a portfolio investment by investment from the bottom up, which allows us to be very selective rather than kind of committing to blind pools or making unfunded commitments. We're able to stop and start investing when we want, and able to deploy capital into, you know, deals in environments and be disciplined through the cycle.
Well, remind us why you consider it important to have private equity in a balanced portfolio. This is a big picture question, but it just puts the whole thing into some sort of perspective.
Of course. Maybe I'll focus on three things. The first, diversification. Second, value creation. And the third is kind of the risk-adjusted return. The first on diversification, companies, as many people know, are staying private for longer. You know, creating a large addressable universe where returns on the private side are driven by private company fundamentals rather than kind of market flows. The majority of companies globally are private. You know, and if you look particularly in the US market, the number of companies, particularly in the smaller mid-market, coming to the public markets is falling. So actually, investors who don't invest in private equity potentially are missing out on a significant and growing part of the opportunity set. In terms of the second point, is value creation, active ownership and long-term holding periods allow management teams and private equity sponsors or owners to focus on really improving the businesses, whether that's through operation improvement, strategic acquisition, market expansion. And rather than focusing on kind of short-term pressures of quarterly earnings or speaking to the broader markets. And the third is, you know, the risk-adjusted return. Private equity has consistently delivered a return premium over public markets. It's a mature and established asset class, predicted to grow at high single digits CAGR over the next couple of years, and attracts significant capital from institutional investors, but also now as a result of regulatory change and product innovation. There's a lot in the news and in the media around the democratization of private markets.
How do you source and win allocations for the portfolio? And how often do you change things? Is there much churn?
It's a great question. From our perspective, this is where the Neuberger Berman private markets platform comes in and is critical, which you mentioned at the beginning. So as you mentioned, Neuberger Berman is an independent employee-owned global asset manager. We manage about $600 billion in assets under management, with approximately $155 billion across our private markets platform. The MB private equity team has been investing in building relationships with leading private equity managers since 1987, so well over 35 years. And we are well positioned within the private markets ecosystem as a capital solutions provider for private equity managers. What I mean by this is we are a partner and ally to private equity managers, not a competitor. We invest alongside them into their funds, at strategies and companies they own and they run. We have a very stable team. There's about 500 of us on the private markets team with about 200 investment professionals. A very high retention rate of senior investors and investment professionals. I think that we have a 98% retention rate. And the joke we sometimes say is that we occasionally let people retire. And on the co-investment side of things, in terms of sourcing and deal flow, you know, it's as a result of these direct relationships we have, which we've built up over many years and decades, you know, with leading private equity managers, is why we see great deal flow, particularly on the co-investment side. They naturally turn to firms and partners they have worked with. And, you know, despite a more challenging period for private markets over a number of years, you know, our deal flow has actually increased materially, given our position as a capital solutions provider for private equity managers. And last year, for example, across our co-investment platform, we were seeing about 12 deals a week. The final part of the question you mentioned about how regularly we can change the portfolio or how often we can change. Once we have given capital in a co-investment to the private equity partner or sponsor, we're very much in their hands. But crucially, one of the big things I touched on before was about being focused on the mid-market. And the reason we like being focused on the mid-market is what we say is optionality on exit. You know, if we're only investing in very large companies, typically the main exit route for those businesses would be through IPO. But crucially, if the IPO market is shut, you're unable to exit those type of companies. However, in the mid-market, there are a number of different ways you can exit a business, you know, whether that's through a selling to another private equity manager, a strategic buyer coming in, and whether that's another private or a public company and buying that business, or through an IPO. So from our perspective, one of the key things we look for when we're doing due diligence on the underlying company and the underlying private equity manager is what is the exit route or what's the exit plan for that particular business? And what is the holding period that we're going to be holding that for? And that is something very important. But crucially, the thing to highlight to say is that once we've invested the money, we are very much in the hands of that private equity manager and expert into them executing on their value creation plan and then exiting that company in due course.
Later on in the podcast, I want to look at the current investment environment. But in a normal market, what gives you confidence in continued access to top tier deal flow?
I suppose the honest answer is depth and longevity of our relationships. I mean, private equity is a relationship driven business. Private equity managers want partners and co-investors who are reliable and can add value beyond just giving capital or money. And we've spent decades building our reputation as one of those reliable partners. As we mentioned before, we've got huge scale and resources with over 500 private markets professionals across 17 offices globally, and have the infrastructure to evaluate and execute on deals at pace, which is exactly what, you know, private equity managers look for in a co-investor. We can write tickets for a range of deals from, say, $5 million up to $500 million in a single transaction, meaning we can be a meaningful and flexible partner, regardless of the deal size. And something we also say is, you know, speed and clarity. We can move quickly, but at the same time, we can give very honest feedback. One of the things we really focus on is, and we say, is no long maybes. which I think GPs value that when they are looking to execute a transaction. And the final thing is selectivity. You know, last year, for example, on the co-investment side, we reviewed about 600 deals, approximately 12 deals a week, and we invested in less than 10% of those. And that selectivity is only possible because of the volume and the quality of deals we receive. Which I think is very, very important.
Why the strong US bias? I think you were saying what something like around about just in excess of what, 3/4 of the portfolio is US based with the remainder in Europe. Why is this? Is this historical? Is this something you intentionally do? Is it easier in the US market to make these good deals?
I think the US is the deepest, most developed private equity market in the world and the most mature in terms of the kind of private markets ecosystem. And the US is unmatched for that globally. When we're looking for the best risk-adjusted returns in private equity, the US consistently does deliver. That being said, 77% of the portfolio today very much reflects where the best opportunities have been previously. It is not a top-down targeted allocation. We see very compelling opportunities in Europe and in Asia, and we have invested in them too. One, a great example of this is the last investment we did in the portfolio, Infragroup, a European infrastructure service business we backed alongside PAI Partners, which operates in Belgium, Germany, the Netherlands, and France in electricity, gas, water, telecoms, and data centers. It's very much underpinned by the long-term infrastructure spending needs and visible demand. You know, we don't want to manufacture geographical diversification for its own sake. Our job is to find the best opportunities and best investments. And right now, that's skewed towards the US. But actually, if you look at deal flow last year, because of what happened in kind of Q2 and Q3 as a result of Liberation Day, actually across our platform, we invested in far more European deals than in previous years. So again, the big focus for us is just finding the best investment opportunity for us, regardless of geography.
So what is the trust capital allocation policy?
The trust has a very simple capital allocation policy or framework. It's made up of two pillars. The first is allocating capital to new and attractive co-investment opportunities sourced through the MB Private Markets platform. And this is the principal use of capital and the primary driver of NAV growth. And the second pillar is returning to capital to shareholders through two components. First, the dividend, and the second is buybacks. And just in terms of the dividend, we are committed to paying a semi-annual dividend of at least 3% of NAV out. The annualized dividend yield on the trust, or on the yield on the share price today, is close to 5%. And since inception, if you take in actually the H1 26 dividends, you know, we've returned approximately $550 million through dividends and buybacks to investors since the fund launched. In terms of share buybacks, which is the other, the second part of the second pillar, if you will, you know, the board announced a $120 million buyback program in February last year, which was going to be executed over 3 years, which obviously, you know, buying back shares at a discount is accretive to NAV. However, in November last year, 2025, they indicated this allocation will be deployed sooner if current market conditions persist. And so through to the end of January this year, we've purchased about 3.1 million shares. So it's roughly, you know, $65 million at about a weighted average discount of about 26.6%.
I was going to ask, before we move on to the current market conditions, to what degree do you use leverage as a tool to accelerate returns?
It's something we're very disciplined about, the use of leverage. Actually, there we have pretty modest leverage at the trust level. It's about 3% in terms of 3% gearing, which is below our kind of long-term average of about 5 to 10%. So we're not highly levered by any means. I think a real focus over the last number of years has been focusing on balance sheet strength. And actually, would be the trust has delevered over this kind of period of uncertainty in terms of over the last number of years. Today, we've got about $291 million of available liquidity, a combination of cash and a revolving credit facility with no unfunded commitments. And the balance sheet is very simple and transparent. That's obviously slightly different from a number of other listed investment companies. The financial flexibility we have is very much intentional, but it's also driven by the co-investment model, which I talked about a little bit before. It gives us the ability, or the model gives you the ability to start and stop investing as we dictate. And so actually, as mentioned, one of the board's priorities the last number of years is very much focusing on the strength of the balance sheet. You might have seen that actually the board in November at our Capital Markets Day announced that given kind of greater visibility on realizations and the strength of that balance sheet, the plan or the intention is to increase allocation to new investments over the next 3 to 6 months to kind of move the gearing level towards the kind of longer term average of between 5 and 10%. So maybe just in conclusion, so, you know, it's conservative by design, but we have real firepower to deploy when we see the right opportunities. And as highlighted, the board announced that, you know, the intention to increase the gearing or the allocation to new investments over the next few months.
Let's take a look now at where we are in the markets. Here we are climbing onto the middle of March. We've got 2 weeks of conflict between the US and Iran under our belt. We've got rising oil prices, concerns about upward pressure on interest rates. What are you doing in terms of consideration, given the changes in the current investment climate and what you expect to happen?
I suppose it's a very fair question, given all that's going on. The honest answer is, you know, our core approach does not change. You know, we remain very focused on high quality direct co-investments alongside the best private equity managers in the world. That being said, you know, uncertainty and volatility does and can create opportunities. But as I mentioned before, MBP and the two core themes that we look at when we're investing on MBP, looking for businesses with low expected cyclicality and certain businesses with long-term secular growth, does mean the portfolio is more defensively tilted. So as I say, you know, we are, you know, clearly it's a more uncertain and volatile, and there's more volatility on the public market side. And I think from my perspective and our perspective, you know, although we have no direct exposure to the uncertainty or the conflict in the Middle East, that what's going to be interesting is the kind of secondary and third order impacts, as you highlighted, of the situation. And I think what we are looking to do is, you know, whether that is, as you mentioned, kind of what that means for, say, risk sentiment, financing conditions, deal confidence more broadly. But, you know, we have seen over the last number of years that actually holding periods have extended across portfolios. And when the exit environment opens up, we think our portfolio is well placed with some very high quality exit ready businesses. So unfortunately, there's not a huge amount of change in what we do on a day-to-day basis. We're speaking to private equity managers on a regular basis, trying to understand the impacts of on our underlying portfolio. I suppose the big key theme, as I talked about before, is, you know, the mid-market focus. And a lot of these businesses are domestically focused within, say, the United States. And so actually, you know, it'd be interesting to see what the implications are of a conflict in the Middle East and how that impacts, you know, domestically focused US businesses. But naturally, there will be uncertainty. There is uncertainty at this moment in time.
But of course, in all honesty, Luke, if we talked at any other time, we'd be talking about some other pressures in the market. And of course, as you say, this really brings about opportunity for those that are active in the market. And I want to ask the question, I mean, 4 months ago, had we been talking about this, it would all have been about AI, of course. How exposed is the portfolio to the AI tech disruption risk and all that's happened? Has that changed anything for you?
It's a question we're getting an awful lot at the moment, is quite understandably, on MBP and across our broader platform. You know, recent derating of software exposure stocks has hit, you know, the equity markets, but also the listed private equity sector more broadly, with discounts actually widening quite materially, given kind of the potential threat that the AI has on software businesses. In our view, and actually for MBP specifically, we thought that there's a bit of an overreaction. You know, if you look at just the actual software exposure in the portfolio for MBP itself, it's only around 11%. And across the wider private equity sector, I was reading a research note from one of the analysts, and they were talking about, you know, the broader private listed private equity sector having between 14 and 34% in some strategies in software specifically. So we're very much clearly at the lower end, but we have been impacted by this kind of broader sell-off, shall we say. I suppose more importantly, not all software is equal. I think that's really important. The businesses we own in the portfolio sit in specialist mission critical, whether that's kind of cybersecurity, property management, education, technology, and logistics. These are deeply embedded businesses with strong data moats and high customer retention. And obviously, AI has been around already for a number of years. And actually, a lot of our private equity managers are using AI as a tool to enhance these businesses and enhance these moats that we talk about. On the other side of things, it can be a very different story. If you've got a point solution that AI generally does threaten, you know, a narrow, undifferentiated software tool that the likes of Cursor or Windsurf can replicate at low cost, then there are some concerns. But I think from our perspective, it's not going to be boom or bust in terms of AI and software, as some people are suggesting. In my mind, actually being private equity backed or being a private equity owned business enables management teams as well as private equity sponsors to be very nimble. And typically a lot of private equity management teams are very highly resourced and incentivized, and in many cases are actively using, as I mentioned, AI to sharpen their competitive edge rather than simply being waiting to be disrupted. So again, you know, it'll be idiosyncratic, it'll be company by company. We are very focused on it. It's something that we, across our investment committee, at every investment committee, we talk about, not just across software, but across all businesses, how what the impact of AI is going to be across business models. And we are talking to our private equity managers about, one, their use of AI within businesses, but also AI as a disruptor and what they're doing about it over the longer term. So very hot topic. Again, we're interested to see how things play out. But from our perspective, from an MVP's perspective, we've got low, pure software exposure, and we are very comfortable. And one of the benefits, as I mentioned, of the co-investment model, we're able to go line by line and look at the individual positions and holdings that are exposed and actually speak to the managers and understand how they are viewing things at the moment.
Well, let's look at the list there and look at some of the big holdings that you have. And in true to what you were saying, if you look back on some of the past presentations, I know you still have on your website, which looks at the context of where we are at the moment with the latest presentation, the list has not changed that much. And there's a certain satisfaction, I think, in investing in something where there's a predictability. Just talk us through some of the top 10 companies that you hold and what's going on to give us a flavour of what you're doing.
As many of you will know, our largest position is in Action, the pan-European discount retailer. We've invested in Action since 2020. The story has been very consistent. You know, they've continued store rollouts across Europe. They've got strong like-for-like sales performance and a very disciplined execution approach. That's been driven by kind of strong earnings growth and repeatable uplifts in valuation during our ownership. Something we've done in MBPE, actually, we've already participated in two realization or crystallization events where we crystallized gains within Action while keeping exposure to the company. This is very much from a portfolio construction perspective. We were very fortunate that Action has been a top performer across many portfolios. And actually was very much, if we hadn't taken money off the table, it would have been a far larger position, shall we say. So actually we have the ability to recycle some of those proceeds into other deals and other transactions. This is very much not a reflection of the business. We still like the company. It's performing exceptionally well, but it's very much more from a portfolio construction perspective that we decide to take some profit. Another great example is Osaic, our second largest holding. Osaic is a large US wealth management platform. It benefits from real scale in the independent advisor channel and has delivered strong organic growth, helped by continued advisor recruitment and deeper relationships with existing advisors. This is translated into both positive revenue and earnings growth, well ahead of the portfolio average. Again, Osaic, as of last year, was a source of liquidity. We had a partial realization of that position and an uplift to carrying value. We have a remaining stake in that company and continues to contribute to performance both on a realized and an unrealized perspective. And maybe the final company I'll talk around is Solenis. It's another great example, is a specialty chemicals and water treatment solutions provider. We originally invested in 2020. It sits in a clear secular growth area, you know, water treatments, sustainability, industrial process efficiencies. Solenis actually did a transformational acquisition in 2023, which we reinvested into, and has done a number of bolt-on acquisitions. It's very much focused on part of the play with Solenis and across a number of portfolio companies within our top 10 is an M&A as a tool or a value creation tool that a lot of our private equity managers are very good at. So buying and acquiring businesses to bolt on to existing platforms and existing companies. It's performed very well. It's roughly 5% of the portfolio today, and we think it's very well positioned.
Yeah, as you say, some of those have had partial realizations. So I was going to ask what triggers a realization. You hinted at this when talking about Action and the fact, I think, what the current balance of that in the portfolio is 6.3%. Is it only you see realizations when you get to a certain percentage? What triggers a realization?
Very much depends. There could be a number of reasons why a private equity manager will want to do a partial realization. They might be wanting to sell a portion of that business to another private equity firm or manager, but maintaining some exposure themselves. So it really depends. You know, typically what you see, it's in co-investments. You know, a partial realization is another tool that private equity managers can use to refresh the underlying investor base within as our co-investment investor base. In the case of some of our portfolio companies, actually what's happening is the private equity manager is buying a greater percentage of that company themselves. So they are looking to increase their own exposure to that business as well. So it really depends. You know, typically, unlike in the listed market space, typically you assume that you'd be having to hold this position until an exit occurs. And with a co-investment, the average holding period of co-investment is anywhere from 4 to 7 years, for example. But in some cases, they are, you know, a partial realization or is a tool that private equity managers can use for a range of different reasons.
Which presumably also includes the prospect of not having returns for shareholders, so you have to make a realisation to bring about investor returns. Is that right, or do you try and avoid that?
Clearly, you don't want to be a forced seller of assets in, or a forced seller of an asset in a difficult situation. But actually, one of the benefits of the private equity market is that you don't have to be a forced seller of assets. You can increase your holding period. And interestingly, actually, it's an interesting point, because an area that we've been finding, or we've been across the platform, is what we call midlife co-investments, where we will proactively approach private equity managers and try and support them across the underlying companies they own, as I mentioned, as a solution provider. And a midlife co-investment is where we're coming into a company midlife, as it suggests, i.e. we are buying into a business. A private equity manager might have held an asset for a number of years already. They don't want to sell that asset at that moment in time, but they might want to return some capital to shareholders, or they might want to continue the value creation plan or buy another business. So something we are doing is we are proactively approaching these managers and identifying companies that we like and we want to own, and saying, well, why don't we come in? We can buy a third of this business off you. Crucially, you don't have to give up control, because the other option is they have to go and sell it in the open, or sell a portion in the open market, potentially to another private equity manager or firm. So actually, these midlife deals now account for around 50% of all the co-investment deals we're doing across our platform. But actually, it allows private equity managers to return, as I said, capital to shareholders, continue value creation of their underlying strategies, but ultimately retain control of their underlying businesses that they might want to continue to hold and grow over time. And another tool actually that we don't focus on in MVP, but actually is very interesting, is the growth of continuation vehicles, which now represent about 20% of the overall private equity industry. And that is a case where a private equity manager wants to continue to hold an asset, but maybe the fund it's in is coming to the end of its life. And so a private equity manager will do a continuation vehicle, or they move that asset into a different structure. And that is something that's seen as a, you know, an additional tool that private equity firms are using to continue to hold on to the best assets.
Yeah, that gives us a lot of context and how you operate. So as we look ahead to the second quarter of 2026, I mean, how's the first quarter gone outside of the recent market turbulence? Has there been anything that is worth talking about, and things that might sort of continue into the rest of the year, which might help shareholder return?
It's a very good question. In our minds, you know, just maybe just give me a bit of a broader market context, and we can drill down into 26 and what we saw. So as we kind of highlighted, the last few years have been a bit more challenging across private equity as an asset class from an exit perspective and deal flow perspective. But 2025 was a, you know, from our perspective, was a very good year, you know, and 25 was actually the second best year for private equity realizations behind 2021, although at times it didn't quite seem like that. But notably, it was very much U-shaped. Q1 and Q4 were strong. And that's kind of pattern we saw in MVP. MVP specifically, last year we received about $180 million in proceeds from full and partial exits at an average uplift of about 70% to carrying value. And we saw about a 50% increase in co-investment exits versus 2024. That represents about roughly 15% of opening portfolio NAV, which is below long-term averages, but clearly from our perspective, the direction of travel was clearly improving and positive. I think the key crucial thing to highlight, despite the market being a bit more challenging from deal flow perspective, actually underlying companies were still continuing to grow strongly. You know, revenue and EBITDA growth of our portfolio is roughly about 10% across the portfolio, with actually our top 10, some of the names I've already mentioned, growing their revenue at about 14% and EBITDA about 16%. I suppose coming into 2026, you know, we were, you know, because of the visibility we had, and as I mentioned it before, the visibility had in terms of the realization pipeline. So again, one of the benefits of the co-investment model is that we can go through our portfolio line by line and speak to the private equity managers. And we have, you know, greater visibility in terms of potential exits over the next 6, 12, 18 and 24 months and specific companies. And we thought, you know, we were optimistic about, you know, given kind of the backlog of exit ready businesses we have both in our portfolio, but also across the broader industry. You mentioned stability in terms of the interest rate environment and returning kind of M&A appetite. And we think the portfolio is generally exit ready. However, you know, the caveat, as we've talked about already, is the escalation of conflict in the Middle East. At the moment, it's just there's uncertainty around what does that mean. And I won't go back into what I've said about, you know, our mid-market US focus and with domestically focused businesses, but that does create, as I've touched on, kind of uncertainty. But more broadly, actually, you know, we think actually fundamentals are strong and were strong at the beginning of the year. We've talked about MVP's balance sheet being in a good place. And we think we're well positioned with some exit-ready companies to, once the environment reopens, to be able to exit these businesses and then reinvest those proceeds into high-quality deal flow that's being sourced by the MB private markets platform. So I suppose, you know, we were optimistic at the beginning of the year. I suppose we're still cautiously optimistic in terms of the environment. We're just going to have to wait and see how things play out a bit more broadly. In my mind, you know, we're very comfortable with our position in the underlying portfolio today. And, you know, very much a keen eye on the macro backdrop. And actually, you know, the hope is that things, the uncertainty dissipates and actually we return to a more a positive environment for deal flow and for deal flow and for activity to improve again or increase.
Fascinating insight, Luke. We'll have to leave it there, but thanks indeed for joining us. It's been a pleasure.
Jeremy, thank you very much for having me.
That's Luke Mason, Principal in the NB Private Equity Team.
We hope you enjoyed listening to the UK Investor Magazine podcast. Please do share the podcast, and we really value any reviews and comments you leave us in your chosen podcast player. The views presented by the hosts and guests of the UK Investor Magazine podcast are in no way investment advice, and please remember all investment involves risk.